Welcome to the second to last lecture on architecture of supercomputers. Before we begin with the actual lecture, I would like to thank you guys for the evaluation. We will discuss that tomorrow in detail, but I'm very happy that 8 people did submit the evaluation. Oh, it's even 9 people right now. No, 8 people. Yeah. If we include the cameraman, then 9. So last time, we did stop after a brief historical overview of the GPUs and how the development went, basically from entertainment devices to programmable devices, which can be used for actual scientific computations. I would like now to continue with a more scientific view on GPUs, not so much a historical view. Who of you knows Michael Flynn's taxonomy? Okay, at least some of you. Basically, Flynn tried to classify computers and also parallel computers. And so his taxonomy basically consists, distinguishes how many instruction streams and data streams a machine has. For instance, a classic single core, non-vectorized, non-simultaneous multi-threading enabled CPU would be a single instruction, single data machine. Probably the microcontroller in my toaster is a SISD device. SIMD. SIMD is probably the most used abbreviation. SIMD stands for single instruction, multiple data, and that's, for instance, used for describing vector instruction sets. For instance, if you have SSE or AVX in your CPU, then you could say that core is a SIMD device. Although I have to say that this MD originally had a different meaning. Originally, this was really did refer to multiple data streams. And classic short vector instruction sets we have in, for instance, x86 CPUs don't have multiple data streams for their vectorized instructions. They typically assume that you're reading a large chunk, for instance, half a cache line, depending on how large your vector word is. And they say this is our multiple data, but it's not multiple data streams. Originally, SIMD did refer, for instance, to vector CPUs, where they could use different offsets for the individual elements in a vector register. So for instance, they were able to fetch one data element from here to the vector register, and another element could be fetched from here. So they were able to do some sort of gather and to fetch the data. Interestingly, the next generation of Intel CPUs, I'm not sure if it's already present in Broadwell or if it will be done afterwards. And what's after Broadwell? Skylake? If that will be able to do scatter and gather operations. Basically, the idea is to extend vectorized loads to include offsets. Okay, but we're not talking about Intel CPUs today. So logically, from this follows multiple instruction single data streams and multiple instruction multiple data streams. This MIMD, that's usually every multi-core CPU, that is a MIMD device, and MISD, multiple instruction single data, that is usually the category where it's difficult to find a practical example. Usually in the Computational Engineering 1 lecture, or at least in the exercise, I give the example of a flight computer. If you have, usually in an airplane, you have redundant systems because you don't want one programming error to down your Airbus because that's expensive and inconvenient for the passengers. Lately, there has been some news on missing airplanes. I'm not sure if that's just because the media is now reporting every issue with lost airplanes, or maybe there have been simply more lost airplanes recently. I wanted to draw a passenger jet, but now it looks more like a warplane from World War II. Let's pretend this is an Airbus. So let's assume you are designing the system which controls the rudder on the tail. And let's say we have three systems. Usually we have just one input, and that is the pilot's input. And we somehow need to facilitate a system where we have three independent systems which can still fail over if one of the system fails. Usually what you do in aircraft is, if you have some rudder here, that you have, you will end up having three motors which are able to move the rudder. And the arbitration, which system is right, actually happens inside the rudder. So if two motors are pushing it up and one motor is pushing it down, the two motors win because they are stronger. So let's assume we have three motors here, and all of them are driven by different computing systems, but they only have one input, which is the pilot's input. So that would be an example for a multiple instruction single data system. We assume that each system is different, it's programmed in a different way, perhaps by a different team, perhaps even using different hardware, but it's all using the same data. But I have to say that this is rather arbitrary. Does anyone of you have a better example for a MISD system? Because otherwise I would say this system is, or this classification is rather a myth, but probably there are no good practical examples. Anyhow. So in this sense, we would say that GPUs are SIMD systems. Actually, if you look closely today at GPUs, you could even say that they are MIMD systems because they have multiple cores. But if we look at one single core, which NVIDIA tends to call streaming processor, then you'd say that this is a SIMD unit, one control unit. We have M register files, M times N ALUs. That's probably not quite true because the registers are not exclusively tied to the ALUs, but they can be distributed, and we have IO units. It always depends on the perspective, how you call which element. So generally speaking, the GPU market is driven by the gaming market, and the gaming market is much larger than the HPC market. So entertainment is simply more money than supercomputing. I think the greater HPC market is somewhere around 50 billion per year. And I think that's just a fraction of the entertainment market. The result is that most GPUs are focused on single precision. You don't really care if your textures are, or if your vertices in your game are placed with 64-bit accuracy or with 32-bit accuracy. It's usually good enough, especially since your display will only be HD, not 4K, perhaps not. The basic properties of GPUs are we have high memory bandwidth, but we have a very different memory hierarchy. So we have large register sets, very small caches, and the whole device is optimized for streaming processing. So CPUs are usually latency optimized. They have large caches, and the assumption is whatever data the user needs next, I hope that I already have it in cache. While the GPU is based around the idea we won't have it in cache anyway. So if the user wasn't able to store it in registers, he'll need to wait for memory, and that wait is very long. So we require the user to run a lot of threads. And by a lot, I don't mean tens or dozens, but thousands, actually thousands of threads, so that the whole GPU can be saturated. The reason for that is memory latency, as I said, is a lot. I think in modern CPUs, it's somewhere close to 100 cycles. For GPUs, it's more than 400 cycles. Usually, if you talk about gaming, then two major players are still stand, AMD and NVIDIA, where I think NVIDIA is usually a bit more expensive than AMD. I'm not sure, but I think their flagship GPUs are usually close in performance. Not? So, who's currently leading? Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I thought that AMD had just released some new device. Anyhow, if you talk about HPC, then you will find very few AMD devices. Most of them are NVIDIA, and there are two reasons for that. First of all, NVIDIA's commitment is stronger to the HPC market, so they have been there first. They have the most mature tools, and actually, there's more CUDA software than OpenCL software. If you write software with OpenCL, then it will run on any device, even though we probably have to say that NVIDIA is not very keen on improving their OpenCL quality. But as I said, most codes that have been ported to GPUs run on CUDA. In the next slides, I will briefly sketch out a couple of different GPU architectures. And I think we could probably start at NVIDIA's Tesla GPU range, because that was the first to achieve broader market success. But I think the most important architecture actually was Fermi, because Fermi was used in some of the larger supercomputers, including a number one system. So that's when GPUs got credibility in the supercomputing community. So the GPUs were called Tesla C2050. There was also a C2075, which differed from the 2050, I think, just in regards of supported memory. I think it had more memory and perhaps even a slightly higher clock speed. And Fermi had up to 16 multiprocessors. And a single multiprocessor is what you see here. One multiprocessor had what they call 32 shaders from an computer architecture point of view. I would say those are not shaders, but they are vector lanes. That's probably more exact. Four special function units for sine, cosine, square root, and such. A small shared memory region, registers. Shared memory and registers are not the same. Actually, there's more, I think there's even more memory for registers than for shared memory, but that doesn't really matter now. And load and store units. Those load and store units are separate from the shaders. So when you issue a load or a store, it does not block the shader. The shader can continue to execute independent instructions afterwards. That's important to note. The shader will only block for a load and store if it actually needs that value in some register. So this blocking and dependency handling is done inside the multiprocessor by the issue unit. What's also important is this is a in-order design. So if you write your code in such a way that you have convoluted instructions where the latency of one instruction is blocking out the other, let's say something like A equals A plus B, and then A is A plus C, and the next two instructions would be X is X plus Y and X is X plus Z. And if your compiler doesn't reorder these instructions, then this won't be very efficient for the GPU code. If it's if this is an in-order design and this actually is an in-order design, because it first will issue this addition, then it needs to wait until this register is ready so it can reuse the updated result for this addition. If we would reorder this so that this instruction comes here, it could issue this instruction, and while this is running, it could already start the next instruction because there's no dependency between those. And once this is ready, it could already issue this one, and once that is ready, it could then issue this one. So there's less waiting time incurred here. But usually you don't really see that, and usually your primary concern is to have enough threads running around. Okay, so back then, this card was very expensive, a couple thousand euros. And few people were keen to spend so much money on what they still considered an experimental technology. So what a lot of people did was they bought GeForce cards. And if you look at the specs, it doesn't even look like the GeForce card is the better option because it has more multiprocessors. The reason why the Tesla card was sold with just 14 multiprocessors and not with 16, which were physically available on the die, was NVIDIA had huge problems with the yield. So this was also the reason why Fermi was delayed, I think by even half a year. It was really late. NVIDIA had promised to publish it much earlier. And yeah, so they were really waiting to improve the process to increase the yield. Now, aside from the increased number of multiprocessors and thus also shaders, the GeForce is also running at a higher clock speed. But surprisingly, the double precision performance is just a fraction of the Tesla performance, and that is because NVIDIA chose to cripple the double precision performance of their desktop products. It also has less RAM, and I'm not sure if this device already supported ECC, but gaming devices usually don't support ECC. So, to conclude this comparison, the GeForce still is a good device because it's cheap and you can play around with CUDA codes, but usually for a server and for scientific applications, you will buy a Tesla card, even though it's more expensive. The next architecture we'll take a look at is AMD's Tahiti. Those slides are actually taken from a from some leaked slides from AMD. So they, even though the architecture is now publicly available for quite a while, the slides are slightly older. So I'm just thinking, when was this released? 2013, 2012, somewhere around then. So this is basically what we are now looking at is what they call graphics core next. And I think this is still the basic microarchitecture they are using, even though they have now been using a newer process and have made minor tweaks, but the architecture itself still stands. What we can see here is a single compute unit, which consists of vector units. So these red lines here. Each vector unit has its own vector registers. We have one local data share, which would be the shared memory for NVIDIA GPUs. We have scalar registers. These scalar registers belong to a scalar core. And we have, what's this here? That's a scheduling unit, texturing units, and texture load and store units, and also a small level one cache. What's interesting is that from an architectural point of view, this architecture is much more appealing to me because we have these lots of vector units, which I can use for number crunching, and I have tightly integrated a scalar unit, which I can use for scalar computations like workflow management and such. So if I had access to all these parts as a programmer, it would be perfect. but I'm only allowed to run OpenCL code on it, so I can probably not harness the architecture as much as I would like to. And yeah, what's also a bit depressing is that the resulting performance isn't that stellar. What's also interesting is that there are really lots of registers. So if you compare this, we have 256 kilobytes of registers per compute unit. And we have 32 compute units on a single chip. So if you multiply 32 by 1/4 of a megabyte just for registers, you'll end up with lots of space for registers. Okay. So this is a different view of the compute unit. This is more a data flow view. What we can see here is the vector units and the scalar units, the scalar unit, and how they are connected to the different data paths. So we have one issue unit which controls which unit will complete which instruction. We again have here the local store, 64 kilobytes. Level one cache is, I think, just 16 kilobytes. And we have the texture units. Are these texture units? No, this is actually, again, level one cache. I'm just thinking where the texture units are. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. So in theory, we could here support C++ constructs like virtual functions, DLLs, and such. But this extension never was, as far as I know, never accepted to the OpenCL standard. So AMD tried to extend OpenCL to support such constructs. Actually, the hardware itself is quite capable. It's even capable of doing virtual addressing. It can use the same address space as the host CPU. I think we'll see also that on the next slides. Okay, this is a more detailed view on the cache hierarchy and how it all connects. What's interesting here is not primarily how this exactly works, but that it is so decentralized. So on each level, you have a lot of intelligence, sort of. Each compute unit has its own level one cache. The level two cache is partitioned, and the level two cache partitions are located at two dual channel memory controllers. So the level two cache is also separated into smaller partitions, which makes it easy to scale because you don't have one gigantic cache which you have to query, but you only have to check which address you are trying to read, and then you only have to query a very small level two cache partition. I think one drawback of this architecture is that here is actually a crossbar. And a crossbar is expensive to build. But we don't know for sure. So no GPU manufacturer will tell you which type of on-chip bus they are using. AMD does not tell us this, and NVIDIA especially won't tell us such details, which is a bit depressing because that's one of the really interesting parts of computer architecture, at least from my point of view. So, for instance, we've seen that when IBM did design the Cell CPU, this ring bus became a huge bottleneck. Then the core counts for Intel designs did increase, and we saw that the ring bus didn't really scale for the Xeon Phi, for Intel Xeon Phi. So the next architecture they are releasing, the Knights Landing, is using a mesh network. We could have told them before because we knew that Cell didn't scale. So, but apparently they were more optimistic about that. Did not work out very well. What we can see now on the modern Xeon CPUs is they still use a ring bus now, but now, since I think they have 18 cores, they're using two ring buses. Did I show you a sketch of how that works? Okay, so you've already seen that. So now today they're using two ring buses, which of course scale better than a single ring bus, but I think it's just a question of time until they will also use a mesh network for their usual Xeon CPUs. Okay. There's more details than are currently necessary. Let's just skip through these. It's also interesting for AMDs that they had a larger cache. I think the newer designs from NVIDIA have also larger caches, but they are sort of trailing behind in terms of cache sizes, even though we can't really rate GPUs by the size of their cache, because their goal was usually to decrease their cache size and do more calculations. What's interesting about the memory subsystem, that's why I spent so many slides on that, is that it's actually very capable. I did mention before that it's capable of using virtual address spaces, which are identical to the operating system, which sounds like a gimmick or something which is nice to have. But who of you has ever used CUDA? Okay, so who of you has ever used a pointed data structure inside a CUDA kernel? Who of you did enjoy this? Okay, so that's no one. The reason why that is usually a huge pain in the, is if you have a pointer data structure in your host memory, then you have all these pointers, and if you then move this data structure to GPU memory, these pointers will have no meaning because they point somewhere, wherever, right? So if you wanted to do this properly, you would also have to copy all the regions where these pointers are pointing to, and then replace all these pointers. That used to be the case for CUDA. Since CUDA 6, I think, you can use not uniform memory, but unified virtual addressing. I think that's what it's called, UVA. And that means basically that you can ask CUDA to allocate memory for you, and it will manage this memory so that pointers will have the same meaning on the device and inside the host. One easy way to implement this is to simply blend in the address space of the device into host memory. So whenever the host accesses this memory, it will fetch the data from the PCI Express bus. That's very slow, but it works. There are more intelligent ways of implementing that. For instance, you could say, okay, we are caching this memory on the host CPU and adding this to a special address space where the addresses are the same as in the device. And whenever a kernel is launched which needs to work on this data, we are simply copying it over. It depends on your use case, which is more efficient. But as far as I know, currently what they always use is just blending in the device memory to host RAM and then forcing the CPU to wait on the PCI Express bus. Yeah, but theoretically, AMD was able to do this much earlier. It's really if you want to bring real world applications to GPUs, you usually want the same address space on the device and on the host. So today, Kepler is still the most used GPU for scientific computations. It has mostly replaced Fermi. So for instance, a couple of months ago, the Fermi GPUs in the Tsubame supercomputer, which is used in the Tokyo Institute of Technology, they were replaced by Kepler GPUs. I think it was the K20 still, not the K40. Even though the K40 was launched just weeks after they replaced the GPUs. So the previous Tsubame was Tsubame 2.0, and after they switched out the GPUs, they called it Tsubame 2.5, which I found a bit amusing, because they said, okay, it's not really a new system, but it's an upgraded system, so we are calling it Tsubame 2.5. In a way, we could say that Titan is Jaguar 2.0, because they replaced all the node boards, but kept the racks. As far as I know, for Tsubame, there are plans to build a Tsubame 3.0, which will be based on new nodes, but yeah, that's still some time away, simply because in Tokyo they don't have the same funding as in Kobe. So you probably remember how expensive the K computer was. It was, I think, $1.2 billion, and Tsubame did cost just 1/10 of that. Okay, so Titan used to be the fastest system for a while, and it's been using, or it is still using, Kepler GPUs. If we compare Kepler, we won't discuss the architecture in too much detail, but basically what we can say is we have more shaders per multiprocessor, 192 versus 32. We also have more registers, but if you compare the resources available per shader, that's actually a step back. So per shader, we suddenly have less registers than before. So perhaps we had previously we had per shader about 1,000 registers, and now it's something along the line 600 something. We still have the same amount of shared memory, so that's a huge step back, and we have lower clock speeds. But because there are so many more shaders, it's still able to deliver a higher peak performance. This also means for the programmer that you have to have much more threads in flight to achieve this peak performance. What's perhaps interesting is that the latest GPU from the latest Tesla GPU from NVIDIA, that's called K80. It was announced in November, and I think it was also launched at that time. So it was a hard launch. A lot of people were not really thrilled by this release because it just meant, okay, we have now basically two Kepler dies in one single device, so it's a multi-GPU device. What few people realized was that for the K80, they doubled the amount of shared memory per multiprocessor. So suddenly, they did not just have 64K, but 128K. And they also, I think, doubled the amount of registers. So from the point of view of a scientific computing person, I would say that the K80 is actually very interesting because the increased amount of registers and shared memory allows us to do different blocking strategies, because suddenly we have twice the space. So we can, if we think about 3D stencil codes, we can suddenly perhaps have different layer conditions fulfilled to do different wavefront updates. If any one of you has access to a K80, please tell me, because I would be really interested. Yeah?
And do you know, say, also increased memory bandwidth for the registers and the cache? Because I know that was a problem when I ported code from the Fermi to Kepler, that the internal memory bandwidth per thread get less.
I don't think that they changed that part of the design. So, of course, you now have a higher aggregated bandwidth because you have two chips on the same device. But per multiprocessor, the bandwidth, I think, is unchanged. I hope that this will change with Maxwell. But currently, there are no Maxwell Teslas. I think they haven't even announced a Maxwell Tesla card yet. But there are Maxwell consumer GPUs available. Yeah. So this is a sketch of how the chip of a Kepler Tesla looks like. In the middle, we have this huge level 2 cache. And each of these fields is a multiprocessor. And what you can see here is in green, those are the normal shaders. And what should be somewhat yellowish-orange is the special function units, and I think those special function units are also used for double precision computations. At least the ratio of double precision to single precision is 1/4. So, what you can see here on the bottom are shared memory regions, issue units. Yeah, I think each device has 4 issue units and registers. Yeah. And if we continue this to Maxwell, what we can see in Maxwell is the multiprocessor is again a bit changed, and suddenly it sort of looks like we have four multiprocessors. Each has 32 single precision and 8 special function units and load and store units. Does anyone feel reminded of something else? I think that if you look at one tile of the Maxwell multiprocessor, it very much looks like a Fermi multiprocessor. So the whole design a bit looks like they used four Fermi multiprocessors in one multiprocessor, each with its own issue unit register set. And what they are sharing is just
here the texture units.
Yeah. So, no, actually, I was lying. These are the texture units. Anyhow, that's still not so much relevant to scientific computing as long as there's no Tesla device with Maxwell architecture. But I'm really looking forward to that. If we are lucky, then we'll see new devices on the GTC in March. Yeah, but that will be after our term, so maybe we can see that in the summer term. Okay, so much for the hardware. Sorry? Oh, yeah. My first supercomputing conference where I was, that was, I think, 2010 in Seattle, or was it 11? Anyhow, no, it was 2010 in Seattle. Microsoft had a huge booth, really expensive, and they were saying that they were doing also high-performance computing, and they had their own MPI implementation, and they were doing GPU computing with their direct compute approach, and it all worked well, but no one in the community wanted to touch that because the whole supercomputing and high-performance computing market is Unix-based. It used to be Unix-based for decades. Now it's all Linux, which is also Unix. There is a small fraction which is using AIX. Which vendor is this? That's IBM. So no one really wants Windows on their high-performance computing system. Not necessarily because people are against Windows. Perhaps the admins are against that, but because no software is compatible with it. No one wants to support their existing 30-year-old code, which is just barely running on any Unix system, to run on Windows. Yes, it's POSIX compatible, but it's still different than Unix. So that's why Microsoft was never really able to capitalize on this market. And the year after, they had just a very small booth, and they were saying, oh, we're doing cloud computing now. Which makes more sense for them, because there, of course, are a lot of people who are doing serious calculations on Windows systems, but those systems consist of 10, 20 cores, not 10,000 or 20,000 nodes, right? So it's a different market. So thankfully, our computing community was not polluted by this. What was interesting, at least in the beginning, was Firestream by ATI, later on AMD. But I'm not sure if this still exists, Firestream. I think it sort of exists internally because they decided to implement OpenCL on top of Firestream, I don't think it's still accessible to the programmer. I'm pretty sure though that if we would grab through AMD binaries, that somewhere Firestream would show up. And of course, there's CUDA. And if you compare Google Trends for CUDA and OpenCL, I think CUDA wins by a factor of 4. Actually, we could try this out quickly. I did say in the beginning that we don't have that much time left in the term, but we have time for that. Open Cloud? No. Wi-Fi in this room is really horrible. Maybe in the end of the lecture it will be ready. Okay, let's continue with the slides. OpenCL was really launched as a competition to CUDA, mainly because competitors of NVIDIA entered the market much later than NVIDIA. So people were afraid, oh, how can we ever break this monopoly, even though it was very small at that time, of NVIDIA. And they said, okay, let's do something open, because companies are happy about open standards, because companies are afraid of vendor lock-ins. Open source developers are happy about open source, open standards. So yeah, that was a good approach initially. But somehow NVIDIA still manages to hold this market captured, mainly because most GPUs which are used for HPC are NVIDIA GPUs, so you might just as well use CUDA if you're already using those. Also because NVIDIA is doing much more marketing, so they have much more teaching opportunities. So they, for instance, you know that our chair is also a NVIDIA Research Center and a CUDA Teaching Center. So NVIDIA did provide us with NVIDIA GeForce GPUs. So if you go up to the zip pool, there are good chances that there will be some GeForce 480 installed in the system. We got those from NVIDIA. And there's also much more teaching material for CUDA than for OpenCL, at least my experience. Also, my experience is that CUDA is more user-friendly, even though my colleagues would now say, yeah, perhaps if you're just starting to learn about NVIDIA, about GPU programming, but afterwards it's just as easy to use as OpenCL or the other way around. But yeah, my view is CUDA is usually more easy to learn than OpenCL. However, whichever standard you use, the general idea is always that you have some grid of thread blocks. And these thread blocks themselves consist of hundreds or even thousands of threads. Actually, this notion of a thread is perhaps a bit misleading, because usually if you ask a programmer about a thread, then people will think, okay, a thread is something long-lived, something that perhaps runs part of my application. So perhaps it would have been more wise to call it a fiber, because a fiber is similar to a thread, but it's shorter. In German, that would be a Faser, I think. And thread would be Faden.
Not sure.
I don't like translating those. Anyhow, so the basic idea is my hardware supports these threads or fibers, and it's somehow able to match groups of threads to execution units. Sometimes perhaps to different vector lanes, sometimes even to a different core on the same device. So I have the same abstraction, namely a thread, which is used to capture two problems, namely vectorization and multi-cores, which is in a way a very elegant programming model, even though everyone will now jump up and say, no, programming GPUs is so complicated. Actually, if you're writing a new application, it's probably not more difficult to use to write a GPU kernel than to write a CPU kernel, at least if you factor in the complexity of vectorizing the GPU, the CPU kernel. Often you will get away with some pragmas for the Intel compiler, but if you're not using an Intel device, but for instance, IBM hardware, then you often have to vectorize yourself. If your code is not trivially vectorizable, then you will also end up writing pragmas. At least that is what a lot of people in the HPC group at this building do. Now, for CUDA, we'll do a short introduction to CUDA. You can write your code in C and C++. Meanwhile, NVIDIA has bought PGI. PGI was known for their compiler, and they also wrote a product called CUDA Fortran, which allows you to write CUDA kernels in Fortran, even though there's a bit more magic involved in that. So I think they handle copying data automatically. The basic idea is to offload functions you try to identify which is your computational hotspot, and then you try to move this hotspot to the GPU where you hope that it will be executed faster. One interesting point here is that Intel would say function offloading, that's so old, that's something people should never do because it really wastes your program structure. And when they launched the Xeon Phi, they said, you don't have to do function offloading for our devices because you can just run your unmodified code on our Xeon Phi because it's binary compatible with the, I think Nehalem was the architecture with which they were binarily compatible. And now, this hasn't really worked out for the Xeon Phi. So currently what they tout is, you should use function offloading for programming your Xeon Phi. They do it a bit differently because they use compiler pragmas to say, okay, offload the following loop. But it's still in a way the same thing. It's still in offload mode where the major part of the code runs on the host device. Which leads us to different functions. So basically, CUDA relies on a compiler, a specialized compiler. This compiler mainly does two things. It separates the code which is tasked to run on the GPU from the host code. The host code will be passed on to GCC. Thankfully, with the new CUDA 7 release, you can also use newer GCC versions. So I think until CUDA 6.5, you could only use GCC 4.7.4, something along that line. And today you can use 4.8 and 4.9 also. The release candidate for CUDA 7 is installed on our servers. So if you want to play around with that and you're not a registered developer, you can still use it on our servers. And the next thing NVCC does is it takes the GPU code and compiles it itself. It's based on LLVM, I think, so since CUDA 4. That was actually a huge change. So we were using a previous version of CUDA and we were doing measurements and we were quite happy with our performance results. Then we got a new CUDA version, recompiled our code. We were very eager to see how much faster it would be, and it was slower. So that was a huge disappointment at first, but it got much better with the more recent versions. So to do this separation, NVCC needs to somehow have a notion which of your code is running on which device. So you can flag your functions with host, device, or global, which means host is default, this will run on the CPU, device will run on the GPU, and global is a special function which is called from the host CPU, but will execute on the GPU. You can also have multiple flags for your function. So you could also say, okay, the following function will be a host and a device function. So it will be compiled for both architectures. And also we have four types of memory. Normal would be host memory. We have device memory, shared memory. Shared memory is located in the shared memory of the GPU. And const can be added to a special memory region on the GPU, which is basically a read-only cache. Okay. Previously, memory management on the device was pretty simple. You could only use CUDA malloc and CUDA memcopy, CUDA free also. Today it's a bit more complicated because CUDA allows more complicated addressing modes and allocation modes. So if we wanted to list all memory management functions for CUDA, it would be perhaps three slides just full of function names. What's important is that a kernel may only access GPU RAM. Depending on how the GPU was the RAM was allocated, it can also today be RAM on the host. So it's a bit different. Okay, so let's just briefly look at some code. Here we have a main function. This creates a thread grid. Each grid consists of 3 times 3 threads in a single block, and the grid itself consists of 2 times 2 blocks. And we invoke this kernel, which just prints out the name of the or the, let's say, the ID of the thread. So it's not doing any calculations. When I wrote that code, CUDA did still support an emulation mode, where it wasn't really separating the host code and the device code, but it would just compile the host the device code for the CPU. And that had the side effect that you could also use system calls inside your device code, because it was just compiled for the CPU, right? Then NVIDIA did disable the this emulation mode, and what was really horrible, because it did complicate debugging. But they later added printf support for kernels. And how this happens is, actually, if you want to call printf, that's not really available on the device, right? Because it's relies on the standard library, and ultimately it has to do a system call. So how they implemented it is, we have this device memory, and there's somewhere as a buffer. And all threads will now, when they call printf, they have a special implementation for printf, which just writes to this buffer. But because all threads are working simultaneously, chances are good that they are overwriting each other's results, depending on how the atomics for the somewhere you need to store a global pointer somewhere to say, okay, we are now writing here, and after I've written, we are now continuing here. And yeah, it can be the output can be quite garbled depending on how much attention you pay to synchronization. But it's still great to have this printf facility inside a kernel. So today you can actually use it on a device. So usually your output will not look this tidy. I did edit it after running it. Even for the emulation mode, it wasn't that tidy. Another kernel, this is actually doing an actual computation. Perhaps not very interesting. This is a streaming triad. So I have three arrays, A, B, and result. And what I'm doing is I'm simply adding X times B to A and storing this in result. I'm not quite sure why this was ever chosen as a benchmark, but an interesting side effect is that this can be the whole calculation here, once the data has arrived, can be done with a single instruction, because all GPUs support fused multiply add. So this would be the main program, which belongs to the kernel we've seen before. In this case, it's a bit more complicated because we have to copy all the arrays. We have to allocate all these arrays. We have to copy the two source arrays to the device. We have to copy the result array back afterwards. If we were using the newer allocation modes, then we could simply say, okay, we are allocating all those device arrays in such a way that we don't have to copy them, because they are implicitly copied.
One question.
Yep.
What happens if you have multiple GPUs installed? How does the program decide on which GPU to offload the kernels?
Yeah, that's a good question. Usually one of the reasons why I'm always slightly bashing OpenCL is because you need probably as much space as the whole main program just to allocate a device, establish a context on this, establish a command queue on this, and then you're just ready to run any applications on this. On CUDA, it's slightly different, because on CUDA you have the notion of a stream, an instruction stream. And by default, you only have one global instruction stream, and this will choose device 0. Whatever device 0 is on your machine. If you want to use a different device, you can manually call CUDA set device, and then all the following instructions will use that device. Usually CUDA stores a context per thread. So if you have multiple threads and each thread says CUDA set device, you won't have a race condition, but CUDA will simply use one device in one thread and the other device on the other thread. You can also use multiple devices in a single thread, but then you have to establish a instruction stream, and you have to pass on this handle to all functions you are using. So in that sense, it's very similar to how OpenCL does it. And you can even have events, just like you have them in OpenCL, to synchronize between different streams. usually you don't see this in in CUDA codes, because usually everyone writes the simple examples without using streams. Actually, even many of the systems, many of the supercomputer systems, only have one device per node. There are a couple of counter examples. So for instance, Tsubame always had three devices per node, which is in a way complicated because it's a two-socket system. So two devices are connected to one host CPU, and one device is connected to the other host CPU, which is also where the InfiniBand is connected. So it's imbalanced, and you have to carefully tune your code to still run efficiently on such an architecture, because you never really know which memory bandwidth which kernel gets. Perhaps it would be more exact to say you never know how fast you can copy data from InfiniBand to the device, because usually it has to pass through host memory, and even if it doesn't have to, you still are not sure if your data needs to traverse the QPI bus too, or if it can remain on the PCI Express bus. When I was in Japan in September and October, there were actually a lot of talks on performance tuning for Tsubame 2.5, because it's not trivial to tune your MPI to this architecture and your CUDA calls to this. Okay, so what's complicated when you're programming for GPUs? Even if you just have one device per node, like Titan, you still have very small caches, but you have a high DRAM bandwidth, so you probably won't rely on the caches themselves, but simply assume, okay, all my data will come from DRAM. What's still a problem is global thread synchronization. So usually if you want to synchronize long-lived threads on the host CPU, you will do this via some global variable, and you can either assume that this variable is somewhere in DRAM where it's stored uniquely, or you can hope that it's stored somewhere in a shared cache where it's accessible much faster. If you want to do synchronization on the GPU and you put some data in global memory, it will always be hundreds of cycles away. So global synchronization is very expensive. So what people did, and what's even to a degree the way NVIDIA would tell you to do this, is to use different kernel launches for synchronization. So assume that your execution threads all need to wait for a certain event. Then NVIDIA would say, okay, launch one kernel for this part, and after the event, launch a new set of threads, which always incurs this launch overhead, which has gotten smaller with the recent releases, much smaller actually, but it's still somewhat, it looks weird if you just chop off a function after a certain point and say, okay, I just need to return because I'm waiting for the synchronization, even though I haven't finished my work. So sometimes it would be more natural to have some kind of future or some kind of continuation like coroutines. What's also a problem is we have basically these vector CPUs, and we don't see the vector lanes because they are hidden in behind this thread interface. But if we have divergent branches, like an if branch, which is taken just by one thread, and the other threads of a warp don't take this thread, then we have the situation which is called divergent branches. And basically, the vector lanes which did not take this branch have to wait for the other vector lanes. It's nice that you can program your CPU in such a way, or the GPU in such a way, but it still leads to impaired performance. Okay, actually so much for GPUs. Any questions on GPUs? Because otherwise I would continue with a very different topic, statistics, which is something which is tempting to overdo. The top 500 is still a very small sample set, so you should not be tempted to overinterpret the numbers. Actually, I was in a session at the last supercomputing conference, and someone my impression was they were overinterpreting what they saw. So they tried to figure out why the top 500 is not growing, or the average speed is not growing as fast as it used to be. And the conclusion was it's not growing fast enough because the accelerated systems are not growing fast enough. Which is in a way true. If you looked at just the past, I think, 5 years, and you would say, okay, growth of the accelerator systems has actually slowed. And the reason for that is it has just slowed because these systems are so expensive, like Titan, or what's the next? This is actually an older slide, so it has changed all here. These systems are simply so expensive that they are only bought every 3 years. So it's just to be expected that you will see a slowdown every 3 years and a huge jump afterwards again. So, yeah. What I'm showing here is actually the two interesting numbers here are peak performance? No, the Rmax performance and Tmax. Rmax is the performance reported by Linpack. Peak would be what the hardware could theoretically do. And Tmax means how many hours did the benchmark run? That's often a number you would not be interested really if you don't know how a Linpack works. Basically, what Linpack does, it's solving an equation system. And the problem Linpack has is initially there's not too much parallelism in the code. So initially you can actually run the first iteration just with a single thread. The next iteration can be run by two threads, and it's always doubling, right? So per iteration you can use twice as many threads. So if your problem size is not very large, but you have a lot of cores, like Sequoia has 1.5 million cores, then probably the performance you will be able to get is not very large because you won't use the whole system for the most part of the calculation. So if you want to run Linpack efficiently on a large system, you want to use a large problem size so that the initial calculations do not carry so much weight. Right? So, but the larger your problem size is, the longer your code will run. The problem with long-running codes is if your system crashes, the whole calculation crashes and you have to restart. And that's bad. So if you want to achieve a good Linpack performance, you either want you want perhaps the longest possible running job on your system. If we look at Sequoia, we see that the job ran for 24 to 28 hours about that. So that's quite a lot if you consider that that the money you would spend to buy these CPU hours is in the millions. So it's not cheap. They were actually using real money to run these benchmarks just to have some number which they could then show to be on some list. So if that was my money, I would probably not spend it. But then again, this is prestige, and they also need to care for their funding, so it makes sense. I'm not sure how long the code on the K computer ran. I'm not sure if that was actually disclosed. But what's interesting to see here is that on Titan, the code did run not even 1 hour, which is not very long. And if you remember what I was saying in the last lecture, the reason for that was Titan was crashing all the time. So they were happy when they had one instance running, which just ran through. And this is also one reason why the gap here between peak performance and maximum performance is so large. If you would look at the student cluster competition, there is virtually no gap between the peak performance and the Rmax performance, because they can run so large compute sets on their very small clusters that they really reach the saturation point. They are very close to saturation point. But if you have such a huge system where you have 500,000 cores and you want to saturate all, and your code can just run not even 1 hour, then you have a huge gap between Rmax and peak. So initially people were expecting Titan to reach 20 petaflops. That's what publications before it was inaugurated did predict. So I'm still convinced that people were not satisfied with these 17 petaflops. But that is actually a growing problem. So the larger our systems get, the longer this benchmark needs to run. There are other problems with the LINPACK benchmark, for instance, that it does not really stress the interconnect. We have a lot of systems in the top 500 which are using Ethernet as an interconnect, and they still can score very well for LINPACK, even though few people would actually use it for serious message passing, tightly coupled codes, because Ethernet is not fast enough. So replacements for LINPACK are underway. The community has currently not really decided on a benchmark, but basically the design goal is to capture more properties of the system. Interconnect should be captured, should play a role, reliability should play a role, and the benchmark should not run so long, because it's expensive. Actually, there are some sites who have decided against running the LINPACK because it's too expensive. Another statistic. How many flops are installed per country? We can see here is that the United States are still leading. I think it would be interesting to see the performance installed per capita. I think even then the United States would probably be leading. Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Sorry, next slide, yeah. Okay, so I was almost right, because the United States would actually be leading this, but in that year, Switzerland had just installed their new system, Pitstain, and so that was, since then, I think the fastest system in Europe, and yeah, so that means, because Switzerland doesn't have too much population, that their percentage per capita is very high now. Even if you look at the log scale, it's still a huge offset. I would really be interested in predicting in the future what hardware trends we will see in the next years, but that's very hard. So I think I'll have some slides on that later on. But we can at least try to take a brief look at the past. And so if you have a couple of minutes after the lecture, I suggest you to visit this URL. So what we can see in the past 10 years was we had two paradigm shifts, namely multicores and accelerators. Do you know which paradigm shifts we had in the 10 years before? That was CMOS logic and PC hardware. So then we had multicores and accelerators. I think people say that about every 10 years we have some new paradigm. So I wouldn't say I know what the future brings, but I know that there will be trouble, because there is sort of the 7-nanometer wall where you can say it's very unlikely that we'll be able to scale our hardware, our circuits, beyond that wall, simply because then there are simply not too many atoms left which we can shrink away, right? So not sure what we'll see then. What's also an interesting approach, which I wanted to note, is Extol. That's actually a German startup company. And their idea is they are participating in the Deep Exascale project, which is, I think, the largest German exascale project. And their idea is not to have what we have today, many nodes with accelerators inside them, but their idea is to have a single cluster which has normal nodes, traditional x86 nodes, and they use accelerators which are packed into their own accelerator cluster. And both clusters are then connected via the Extol network. So basically, to the hardware, the Extol network looks like a very large PCI Express bus. Of course, it isn't electrically, but they translate these protocols. What's interesting here is But the hardware development is actually moving away from separating those. So plans for NVIDIA and IBM are to tightly integrate GPUs with power CPUs, or NVIDIA has also licensed ARM cores, so they could also integrate ARM cores in their GPUs. So I'm not sure if this separation will actually be a good concept for exascale systems, but yeah, we will see.
What's mayhem?
Yeah, well, no one really knows what's beyond the 7-nanometer war. So chances are that we will have, that we won't have a superior technology for that afterwards. So it may very well be that we will sit around with the same manufacturing process for 5 to 10 years until someone's actually able to use photons on a chip or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It should be interesting. The thing is, when I was studying computer science, my professor said people were basically talking about Moore's law and how it won't be feasible to continue this any longer. And many people did equate Moore's law with the frequency scaling we saw. And he said, if frequency scaling stops, and it had already stopped, but no one knew because we didn't know any further data points, and he said there will also be mayhem because our codes always rely on the CPUs becoming faster. No one's really parallelizing their codes. And now the CPU, or at least the single thread performance, hasn't really increased. And still the world has not ended, right? So maybe we'll just adapt to stagnating manufacturing processes. What we're currently seeing from software perspective is that it's very interesting to write software now because we have to think harder about parallelizing it. So maybe if manufacturing processes stagnate, people have to think about more about architectures for high-performance computing or for computing in general. I think we also have, I have some slides on future design approaches, but that's something for next week. For the next slides, I think we still have some time, at least a couple of minutes. I'm always confused because we start so early with the lecture, so I tend to think we have time until 2 o'clock, but it's just until 1:30. Okay, so let's take a brief look at systems from Bavaria and beyond. I realized that I'm now here in Franconia, so we are not technically part of Bavaria. I did update this slide. So I think I have the older version coming up behind that. If we look at the current top 500, actually Germany is doing quite well. So Ukraine is still the fastest German system. That's a BlueJinQ, so I won't be detailing its architecture because you already know it. SuperMUC in Munich with 2.9 petaflops is, I think, one of the fastest, or is it even the fastest Intel-based system without accelerators? So that sort of makes it special. What is very new is Hornet, based in Stuttgart, Hochleistungsrechenzentrum Stuttgart. That's always good if you can pronounce that for English native speakers because they are amazed by this long guttural sound. I'm not sure what they are thinking, that they are slightly slower than SuperMUC. I'm pretty sure they would also be happy, have been happy to exceed that. As far as I know, the system's also using GPUs. There is one IBM system at the Max Planck Institute, I think that's also located in Munich, which is running at 1.3 petaflops. What is a bit sad about this system, it does not have a code name. So if you look at the top 500 list, you will see that they are using IBM iDataPlex servers, but it doesn't have its own name, which I think is sad. Also, one of the newer systems is Konrad. This is not Hochleistungsrechenzentrum Nürnberg. This is Hochleistungsrechenzentrum Nord. So basically, all the poor northern federal states have united and said, OK, let's share some money and buy at least one supercomputer for us. So if you would draw a map, I think I'm allowed to say this because I studied in Rostock, and I actually I'm from what you would call Preußen, Prussia. Is it pronounced that way in English, Prussia? So I'm from Nordrhein-Westfalen, which technically also belongs to the poorer part of Germany, but because Nordrhein-Westfalen is so large, they were able to afford the fastest system, your queen. I didn't know about your queen when I was still living in Nordrhein-Westfalen, but that's a different story. So, okay, Hochleistungsrechenzentrum Nord has this Konrad, which just made it to one petaflop. And there's still Hermit. Hermit is also located in Stuttgart. So they didn't switch off the system yet, just because they had a faster system. And there's also our system, EMI, which is doing 100 teraflops. And it's also here on place 331. So it's just barely on the list, but it is on the list. If we would go back 1 year, I was so sure that I had also the older slide. Just let me have a look. Okay, let's conclude what I was looking at here. OpenCL versus CUDA. Yeah, so what we can see here is CUDA was an established search term for a couple of years until OpenCL was launched. And now OpenCL, interest in OpenCL is pretty stable. And CUDA is right now declining. Perhaps we could say that there was a hype here and now people are realizing that CUDA, that GPUs are not 100 times faster than CPUs, which is what some papers still claim. So let's see what happens, if they will somewhere converge or if CUDA has reached a rather stable level here. What I wanted to look at is actually one of our older slides. So, yeah. So this is the slide I was promising you from last year. It is very similar to what we've seen before. So a couple of systems are missing here. So for instance, Konrad was not there. There was no Hornet. So basically these systems here, Gottfried and Löwe, have been replaced or have been moved out from the top six. I just chose the top six because that I managed to fit that on one slide. So it doesn't have any real meaning. What's perhaps interesting is that 1 year ago, EMI was on place 210. And just 1 year after, it's on place 331. So it moved down quite a lot in just 1 year. And chances are that if we have no replacement next year, it might even fall off the list. We will see. As far as I know, no contract has been signed, but talks are underway to procure a new system here. I'm not sure where they want to place it because cooling right now is already bad enough. We will continue with Lima and some, I would say, some preview for exascale designs in the next lecture. Tomorrow in the exercise, we will discuss series 6 of the exercise and also the evaluation. As I said, I'm very thankful that so many of you did complete the evaluation because that actually allows me to read something out of that. And in the exercises in the next week, we'll skip briefly through all the slides and I'll give you a brief overview of what is important for the exam and whatnot. Okay, so that's it for today. Thank you very much for your attention.